This is side two of an interview between Dr. Douglas and Air Vice Marshal Howsam, dated August 28, 1975.
Well, Doctor, you got to the end of your time in Manitoba and Camp Borden and Staff College. Then you came back for 2 years or a year of staff duty at Air Force Headquarters.
Nearly 2 years. I was a staff officer operation, sending the photographic things down to wherever they went, photographic and everything else. Any operation that other federal government required, that's where Zimmerman was working with me very closely there, and he was one of my chief pilots who, well, he was the man that I sent on the most difficult job.
Can you enlarge on that a bit? That sounds very interesting.
Well, there were a number of difficult jobs that were going on in 30, that'd be 31, parts of 31 and much of 32. And they were going then well north, right down to the deep Arctic. And Clemen was probably the number one man that we had. Now, that's probably not to be, I don't mean to denigrate the others. But you will always find in a team of that kind one that stands right out. You may have two, and if you do, have two, you're lucky. Mm-hmm. But in the wintertime, we talk about flying in the wintertime on skis in the north. He was able to do that then with great, he had the ability to know when to go on and when not to go on. Mm-hmm. You don't run into the mountains or you don't run into the weather. And he could pull off a difficult operation.
Yes.
Simon was, he was excellent at that. And he was then, I think it probably was like a 10th. I'm sure he wasn't friendly.
Well, these were your most important things as staff officer operations.
Well, we had everything. We had the rum running, and then we looked after the rum running, the anti-rum running. The Mountain Police had no aircraft of their own.
Yes,
we were doing it for them. And Jim McBride, Mr. James McBride, incidentally, James McBride had gone to the same high school that I did years before, and he'd been in South Africa and came back to the store. So I knew him well,
yes,
his family. And he was the chief of the RCMP. And about, I don't think he'd become Sir James then, but thereabouts.
Did you have any records that you kept from that period?
Well, I made a few trips down to the Maritimes, but most at the Maritimes. I remember very, very well that the oysters were terrific in Chediac. Occasionally that someone who would be just accidentally would have a gallon of uncut rum. I could bring it back to Ottawa to my friends and the mess. I never kept it. It's a very good rum, uncut. But that shouldn't be on record. You shouldn't.
No. Well, the...
I didn't object to it in many ways.
No. As a staff officer operations, though, now, weren't you responsible for developing the RCAF along more military lines, too, at that period?
No. Excuse me. I should have been staff officer of civil government.
Right. All right. Now, but after that, you...
And after that, later on, that would be some year after I came back from Toronto.
Right.
Okay. Oh, no, not at that time.
Okay.
And I would say at that time there was very little of that being done at all. There may or may not have been a position there, but I don't recall.
Well, now, you went to Toronto from Ottawa,
yes,
and you were the first air officer on the military district.
We called them senior air staff officers.
Yeah.
Same as the GSO-1.
And did you have direct channel to General S. Anderson, wasn't it?
T.V. Anderson, definitely. It was very amusing. T.V. Anderson had one arm. Mm-hmm. Magnificent soldier. He's as tall as you are.
Yes.
Carried himself just beautiful. I didn't want to go because his reputation was he was a very tough soldier. And difficult to get on with. I found him just reversed. Mm-hmm. It was an ideal soldier. He knew exactly what he wanted. He'd asked for it. He never told you, not the first time, anyway. And if you delivered the goods, that's all you had to do. And I adored him. But he had one arm off, and he had one trait of character. Never try to help him. If he wanted to struggle with his coat, let him struggle. If he wanted to, well, there are a thousand things that happened there with him that was most amusing. But the very first morning I went in with my files in Australia, and I remember the GSO of the Army, he had an office right next door to the general. And the A and Q and G, the Colonel Administration, had the officer on the other side. They never thought they'd have an air staff officer around there of that kind. I was poked off. I had a very nice accommodation, but some distance. Well, I had to run along the hall and walk along the hall, wherever, right with my files under my arm. They had no distance to travel. They could just get up off their seats and go in. But the GSO-1, well, Colonel Goody, he may have passed on now. I don't know. He's pretty elderly. And he was always fumbling. He never went to staff college. He didn't know how to arrange things. And he'd get all his files ready, and then he'd think of something, you go back, and there was a table just outside the general's office, and between his the GSO-1's office and then the general. He'd always be fussing around on this table, but of course anybody else in the building never would think of passing him while he was fumbling there. He'd say, well, I came down the hall, I had direct access, and walk in, and he was still fumbling when I go in. But anyway, I remember everybody with a bunch of files, and one had a nap on, all beautifully folded and so on. He read the paper, and he's quite happy about that. He decided to take a look at the map. He threw it out that way. Then he decided himself that he'd put it together again with one hand. I was looking out the window across the empty floor, talking out of the corner of my mouth, but never stopped talking to her. He was answering his questions. Finally, he found out he couldn't do it. He turned around and he said, "Hussain, for God's sake, help me." I didn't tie his shoe or do a goddamn thing that he told me. And actually, we got on from there perfectly. But he was a damn good soldier. Mm-hmm. And I think he just stood very high. Yeah. I have the best soldiers that I've ever...
We're very fortunate in him as Chief of the General Staff at that crucial period.
I think you would be, yes.
Yeah. Now, this is the time when you organized Number 10 Non-Permanent
That's
Squadron.
That's right, in Toronto. And the one in Hamilton.
Right. And the City of Hamilton Squadron.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Now,
it's Freddie Tice, you know, and McGregor. Freddie Tice was your chief medical officer during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
He was the doctor of the squadron.
I see.
And McGregor was the CO, and there was another McGregor there. Brother or cousin, I've forgotten, but both had been World War I pilots. Both McGregor's. Oh, I know a bunch of them all, but some of them are off the top of my head. Ayres and Hamilton.
Right. Now, these were Army Co-op squadrons, or these number 10 was.
Yes.
Did they look to the Army for supplies, or did the Air Force look after them directly for supplies?
We looked after them directly. There was no contact in that, no. Unofficially, yes, because we got on beautifully with the Army there. The militia, the non-permanent squadrons in Toronto in the 30s were right out of this world. Heavens above, when anyone came from England or various ambassadors or what have you, we put on a parade in Toronto. 99% of it was militia. And they were, my God, the bodyguard, beautifully, the horses, I think, now the two great two stores there, Eaton's and Robert Simpson's, and one supplied the horses to one unit and the equipment, and one supplied it to the other. And, God, the cadet corps alone at Upper Canada College had a band that just knocked your eye out. It was unbelievable. Unless maybe you could be around them.
That was
like,
before my day.
I see. Well,
but in the war, I was there in the war when the cadet corps at Upper Canada College.
Well, during the 30s, their band. I think the band was stronger than anything else, but my God, there wasn't a band in it. But the whole militia set up there. Mm-hmm. Now, that's what Anderson insisted on taking me around with him, using his ABC, to see what the hell was going on. And I went to, I know the Army weren't very happy about it, but I was being taken too much with the Donald. But he always detailed me. He said, "Hudson, I want you to do them." That's it.
Did the Army ever indicate that it wanted to take over the squadron?
Oh, no. No, never. It wouldn't have happened anyway. There's never any indication or any thought of it, as far as I know.
And what were the chief problems you had in the newly formed squadron?
Oh, equipment. You see, we could get a few aircraft for the flying pads. If we were always pulling for Wilson to get his for his flying pad.
Mm-hmm.
Jay Wilson. But we had to pull for ourselves in the non-permanent squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And we could always get a few. So, but my God, every time any one of us opened our mouths, some member of Parliament would get up and shout from the treetops and the housetops about salesmen are best, and oh, dear God, that went right down to even after Mr. Umbrella came back from Munich.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah.
But again, I'll take you forward to that thing. The idea of the developing the flying club, that was not ours. The idea came through the United Kingdom. And we didn't let on in Canada. In fact, we didn't let on. Sir James Robb, or at least he was then Group Captain Robb, and I'm diverging, it doesn't matter. Quickly.
Nope.
Summer 37, damn the memory, Mackenzie King said no to the training plan. Definitely no. The British government tried to sell it to him. He said no, no way. That fall, that is all that happened. Now, the next spring, very early the next spring, Group Captain Robb suddenly arrived at Government House. Nobody knew that he had any appointment. He didn't have. He just stayed there. And he stayed there all through 38. And all through, went back part of the winter and night that winter. He came back again in the spring of 39. And he was just there. And having been a staff sergeant again since I was the director of training, you know who's... And furthermore, two or three, Gus Edwards, didn't like him around there. He wouldn't even try to give him an office or a desk to sit at. He used to sit nowhere. Well, I had a good big office, and I ordered another desk and a chair, and I said, "Well, Jim, that's your corner." And he stepped in my office the best part of the 2 years. Well, he's a damn fine fellow, but his whole idea was that we would get on the right track in the right way. And we lived up in Rockville that summer of 38 and 39. There were hot summers and all that. And by God, at night, about after dinner, he telephoned us. He's like, "George, it's hot down in this goddamn Saddleroy Hotel. Could I come on up and see you?" Well, of course, we'd sit on our veranda up in Rockville, up in Blackwood, for the damn living. Wee small hours. I personally didn't want the training plan in Canada any more than I want the Canadians to do our own job here, the same as they'd done in World War I. I said, "That was good. Go on to the Egypt." And he said, "Oh, but we mightn't hold the Mediterranean." I said, "Don't be damn silly. You've had it for 15 years, Mr. Same thing." I said, "Well, all right. Go to Australia. That's good. Go to South Africa. You did it in War One. Go to Rhodesia. They had training units there before. We don't want to be school teachers." He said, "Well, that's all very well, but you know goddamn well from your staff college training that whenever you make a war plan, you've got to..." Sorry, there's one that damn fly. I left the door
open. Okay.
"You've got to make a plan to take care of the ultimate." And he said, the answer to all of these questions is this. This is the answer. If the chips go right down, as in War One, we only had enough sea power, and we had damn little air power we didn't need in War One to keep the channel open, keep the ships working one street, if you like, or one channel between the UK and what you call the arsenal of democracy. Now, we've still got to keep that open. we may not have enough to keep a second one open. And if we ever get to and we did get to that stage, that was the key. That's why the training plan had to come here. He said, you can't put it any other place. Mm-hmm. And he said, furthermore, and yes, please do. Furthermore, by all means, Reg, furthermore, we are going to need 10 times as many pilots this time, or 1,000 times. We don't know how many. And how right Trenchard, he is the disciple of Trenchard and his team. He had a whole team in there. Mm-hmm. And I know damn well it's coming. He told me. God damn it. It was the one thing that saved not only Britain, but the whole damn lot. You see, in the first 2 years after war broke out, before Pearl Harbor, a flock of people came from the United States up here. They were sitting outside my office. One came with a letter from the Marines, the Colonel Geiger. Mm-hmm. He resigned his commission and come up here. I said, well, we've got 1,000 applicants here from old war one people. And I just can't do it. He said, I suppose after about, he sat there for damn near a week. Every day outside my office. And I said, for God's sake, a moment of weakness, I said, now if you're only a Canadian. He said, what? He took off, I think that was about Thursday, and on Monday morning he was back with a passport. Born at Huntsville, and I, oh my God, well, he, sure, I took him in. Now, you've got to go down through the mill tunnel, but if let on that you're a trained pilot, you've got to take a reasonable time. I gave him about the number of days. You'd be a flying club person, but with your skills, mm-hmm. be careful. Hell, he had far more skills than his little fingers and 2 days of instructors. Mm-hmm. But that is just one example. We had that went right on until after Pearl Harbor. General Henry from the United States took a train, and I don't know where he started in the east, but he came right across Canada, mm-hmm. interviewing the Americans that we had up here who wanted to go back to the United States. He stayed nearly a week with me mm-hmm. in my command from down to Calgary and so on. But a good number of them stayed. But what I'm getting at is that fantastic. Well, the word fantastic is that excellent liaison between the two countries. Hell, we had a forced landing before the Americans were neutral. We had one forced landing that took place in the vicinity of right across Lake Ontario, the other side in Rochester, in that vicinity. And my God, the neighbors, the friends turned out, pulled down fences, got them over into another field. Fed them up. The kids just couldn't do enough for them and send them back. Yeah. Nobody heard a damn thing about it.
Lovely.
So, why not?
Yes. Yeah.
Lovely.
Can we go back to 36?
Yes.
You went to number 2 Army Corps, Squadron at Rockford and Trenton.
Yes.
And
T6.
What part did the Army and what part did General Norton play in forming that squadron?
Well, he didn't form any part in forming it.
Okay.
The thing had been formed as early as 1929. Mm-hmm. It had been around, but it was gradually growing. It was probably more like a flight than a squadron to begin with. Then it became 2 flights. By the time we got to Ottawa, by the time I took over, we had 3 flights.
Mm-hmm.
Because they built another hangar and we had that old... I think the old war machines are in one of those hangars now. But we worked very closely with the Army. We went down to... as the only one in Ontario, the Army Cooperation Squadron in Ontario, or Quebec that I remember. There's one that is in Ontario, of course, but I don't remember. I know we went to Quebec and worked with the Army there twice. Once I drove... my car driven down there so I could use my own car, so I know it very well. They didn't have very good roads in Quebec at that time once you get off the main highway. McNaughton was certainly very helpful in everything. He's never anti in any way as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when he got the flu 1 week. He worked all for 7 days a week and 30 days a month, but he got the flu, and he would call me up about 4 o'clock in the afternoon when the doctors had him in bed and he couldn't get up. And he lived over in the upper end of Sandy Hill. And I'd go in there right after I'd leave the office, and I'd never get home time for dinner. He was working out. He was nuts on gunnery. He was a gunner. Oh, he was a gunner, and a damn good one. But he was working out a new idea of shooting down aircraft. So after about 3 or 4 sessions of this, I said, "Look here, I'm going to stop discussing this, because hell, if you didn't let that gun, you're going to start shooting down our airplanes." He had a sense of humor. He was getting right on with it. But then fortunately he got well, and he could go back to work. And I don't know what happened to his gun.
Did you do many exercises with the Army at this period?
Well, yes, we did.
Were they successful?
Within the limits of what they could do and within the limits of what the aircraft could do. But we were still governed largely by the technique and the tactics of War One, because our aircraft and our equipment were damn little better. You see, I was accusing the generals for getting ready for the last war. Well, hell, with the parliament and your government and your equipment, what else have you got to work with? If you do anything else, you do it on paper.
Yeah.
So the generals aren't to blame for getting ready for the last war. It's your government for the kind of calling the tune, in my opinion.
Yeah.
The McNaught was very good.
Yes, that's good. Well, the final bit before the war I wanted to ask you about was as director of training, which really was a crucial appointment.
That's right.
And,
I think leading up to that was Rob, you see.
Yes.
Rob was the one who explained it so clearly to me what they're doing in the United Kingdom, and I'm not going to take any great credit for it, but we had got a good number of, we had flying club instructors right across Canada, at least 2 in every flying club who would come in and taken their training at Camp Gordon and were invaded. And again, for every one of those clubs, we had to have a number of mechanics mm-hmm. who had been trained in our system and were graded, able to sign out aircraft.
Yes.
With the result, another thing we did that Rob was quite keen in helping me to figure out, we found out, I would say 50%, about 50% of our own pupils mm-hmm. into the flying clubs around April or May 1939, immediately after, you remember Chamberlain's speech at Liverpool where he cried and said, Hitler had been untrue, you know, he'd broken his gentleman's word or something or other. That was about April 39.
Mm-hmm.
So we found out around about that time, maybe just after, about 50% of our training to the clubs. And I think we started off with 4 pupils to each club. And then we upped that to 8. I think it remained at 8 until war broke out. But my God, as soon as war did break out, we were able to take the whole of our training, initial and elementary, out of our main schools at Camp Borden and at Senton, heave them out into the clubs, and they were trained for it. And we doubled the intake the next month of people coming in.
Do you recall Mr. Seymour at St. Catharines?
No, he's a Major Seymour. Major Seymour, and he got a CBE. What's his first name again? Major...
I've got it.
Major...
Well, the old age.
We've had some chats with him. And
well, I'd like to be with you when you're chatting with him sometime, because he'd been the... head of the flying clubs for 1 or 2 years before. He was working with Jerry Wilson and with Mert Seymour.
Right.
Mert had been one of my best friends. I'll tell you about Mert. When the balloon went up
in September the 3rd, the first man I called on the telephone at night, I picked it up and I said, "Well, Mert, the goddamn balloon has gone up. What are you doing?" He was in Scatland. Said, "Can you come down to Ottawa for a while?" He came down and sat in Ottawa without any pay for the best part of a month. And said, "I'm going to put the whole ready thing out, you see, as I told you. Dump everything out of Borden and and strengthened in the clubs. Neither we don't want the thing to go belly up. We've got to consider what we do each step.
Yeah.
But you've got to be aware, and I've got to be aware what the hell we're doing. Well, Gus Edwards didn't like it at all because he didn't know what was going on, and Gus was supposed to be the head of personnel, and he was very rude to Mert. But Mert Seymour never got, even with his CDE, he never got the recognition of the job that he did in that case. After all, you take an Army or an Air Force military deal, working with a civil one, to get that kind of cooperation. Well, he'd come down there. You ask him who paid his hotel bill. I'm damn sure no one did. We could have done. He paid his own bill, and he was there the best part of a month, and he did a hell of a good job. So Mert Seymour stands very high in my estimation.
Very good to know.
Anyway,
you've answered a lot of questions
anyway,
here
anyway
already.
It worked. Anyway, it worked. And without men like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mert Seymour may have been succeeded by Brigadier McCusker in Regina as the head of the thing. And McCusker was good, but he's a new boy.
Yeah.
And until the Brigadier Medical. But it didn't make any difference. He was still a damn fine fellow.
Mm-hmm.
But he hadn't had the background experience that Seymour had. Mm-hmm. Mert Seymour was he'd been a major in the Air Force, in Franklin.
I see. Right.
Oh, yes.
Right, okay. I was, for a moment, confusing him with Sport Merton.
No, it was Mert Seymour. Yeah. Major Merton Seymour.
Yeah.
I think he's still alive.
Oh, yes, he is. He is. And he's got a lot of papers that he's left.
Well, all right. Pardon? He's left you?
Yeah, he's let it happen.
Oh, I see.
Do you have any papers for this period? I keep on coming back to this
question. Well, yes, I have papers, but I'd have to dig them out. I haven't got them made to build today. Oh, well, yes, I have them in the cabinet. One thing I must warn you. When you were where you are right now, you'll have good secretaries.
Yeah.
If you haven't, you haven't trained them properly. When you retire and you become your own secretary, you probably have I have the untidiest office in the world.
Me too.
Next to this. And God Almighty, if I only could have a good secretary.
Yeah.
God, a good secretary is worth a great goal. There's nothing in the world. Mark, if you train them properly, they become good secretaries.
That's right.
I have them, and they can be available to you any time you like. I'd like to dig them out.
I think George will have to have elect them out again, don't you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Stay along. Don't you?
We'll make it work this time a little bit. You can speak to my class, talk to you again.
Yes. Whatever, anything you like.
I'd love to. I'd love to.
But I'd like to dig them out, including the draft of the thing.
That would be most valuable.
But I'm not valuable. Going to let them out. They're not Nixon papers. They're not going to get anywhere else except here.
Okay. Okay.
Not too far. Oh, well, I won't go that far, but...
You'd like to make Xerox copies of them?
Oh, hell sure. Anyway, you like.
One thing about...
They stepped up, you see, this thing started off Rob is still here. And he was in direct communication with London all the time. He's staying and living in government house, Rita Hall, with the Governor General.
I would like to know more about that, because this ties in with what was happening with the Navy.
But you see, you can't tell that story too well because Rob's dead now, so his work was super, in my opinion. Mm-hmm.
What about, we have interviewed Air Marshal Leckie a lot in the past, but I'm sure we never got the full story from Air Marshal Leckie. Now, one or two questions I have about him. One was... as director of training in the RAF, was there ever any contact between you and he?
No.
Second question, when he came over,
February 40, about then.
What was the reaction to him really moving in and taking over.
Right. Let's have the other half.
We have only about 5 minutes.
Oh, well. All right, then. Well, no. You can't do it. Okay. I'll put it to you this way. There was no doubt about it. The director of training position at that time suddenly jumped from a group captain job to, ultimately an air vice marshal. Yeah. Now, I certainly not going to begin. In those days, the training was all via seniority. There was no other way. And I had been asking to get the hell off the chair anyway. I wanted to get out of the troops. And I'd asked for it 2 or 3 times. So that was all right. They gave me a quick trip to England and look around, and then I was in France. And now, we're coming back to Leckie. They brought G.O. Johnson in and made him the director of training. And he never had any experience in that field at all. He'd never been a flying instructor even. He was probably the least trained man, and he needed the crutch. So he went to England before, persuaded Leckie to... And Leckie had been passed over twice in the United Kingdom in his seniority. He delighted to get out, because he'd been very lucky if he'd gone any higher than... He's an air commodore then.
Mm-hmm.
And they made him an air vice marshal right away.
Mm-hmm.
And Leckie had a lot of good qualities. But he'd run out of Canada when, back in 1924, he had a permanent commission, you see, in the RAF, and he, when they formed the RCAF, he decided that he would go to the RAF and back and take his permanent position in the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
So he was more of what I would call a safety first person.
Well, of course,
why did he want to run away back to England?
His reason, and it was, I've just been through this in the Hitchens papers. I forget who the other person was, and Glenn was another.
Jimmy Glenn was one. Glenn and Bob Leckie.
And there was another too. And Collishaw has put this across too, was profound disagreement with the whole policy of the RCAF being subordinate to the army and not relishing the future of the
God Almighty, we weren't happy about that, but we stayed and fought it out, and we won it. But you didn't win that kind of battle by